No debate, no bias, just the news. Brass Tacks with Zucker Jacob.
Hello and welcome to this Brass Tacks podcast. It's weeknights 9:25 on CNN News 18. I'm the host of the show, Zucker Jacob, and with me, as always, Anusya Kumar. Anusya, what do we have tonight on the show?
What a packed show we have lined up tonight, Zucker. One of the big stories that we'll be looking at is what's happening in Kashmir. Six migrant laborers, all from West Bengal, have died in a terror attack in Kulgam. It's coming at a time when members of the European Parliament are visiting the state, and they have said that they stand by India in its fight against terror. All of this, the timing of all of this is extremely crucial, isn't it, Zucker?
It is, and I think the attack in Kulgam is deeply worrying. You know, it's bad enough that six migrant laborers have been killed, but there's a pattern here, and I think over the last 10 days to 2 weeks, you've had about a dozen people killed.
12.
All of them were outsiders. They were from outside the state. So what is going on here? I think what the terrorists, absolutely vicious people who carried this out, are trying to send out a message, particularly to the outsiders, don't come here. I mean, you come here, we're going to, you know, separate you out and we're going to kill you. So I think the intent behind this killing is to send out a chilling effect, which is where I think, you know, the government, the Jammu and Kashmir police, for example, is suggesting that, you know, the terrorists are doing this so that the people don't come out and resume normal life.
Yeah.
I think that's where they're getting it wrong. Because if that was the intention, then they would kill the locals. They would not kill the outsiders.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think what they're trying to do by killing the outsiders is to tell the outsiders, don't come here. Kashmir is not open for you. Which was the exact purpose with which the government said, or at least that's how they sold it to the rest of the country, that Kashmir is now fully integrated. You can, I mean, they even said you can go and buy land there. You know, it's one nation, one constitution. I think the terrorists are trying to send out the opposite message to the rest of the country, that it is not one nation, one constitution, that it is just because Article 370 is gone, it doesn't mean integration. It doesn't mean outsiders can come here and do business, whether it was migrant labor or apple traders or truck drivers. I think that is deeply worrying. And I'm not sure what the next step by the government, by the security forces is, because they seem to be operating with just, you know, one trick in the book, and that is to clamp down further. You can't keep doing that, because as you've seen, there is a backlash to it.
Yeah.
We've seen that in the US Congress last week. We're seeing that in the blowback to this visit of the members of the European Parliament, which in any case, I think, you know, if the attempt was to try and make this into a bit of a PR exercise, I think that's exactly how it's turned out to be. It's become a PR exercise.
You cannot possibly say that things are absolutely normal there.
Yeah.
It just doesn't add up.
Yeah. And I think so. I think the government needs to go back to the drawing board and see, you know, I'm sure they've gamed it out even when they abrogated Article 370. Clearly, this hasn't gone the way they gamed it out. They need to put a flowchart or a roadmap out on the table. This is when we think we'll be confident to take off the internet clampdown. This is when we think the high-profile politicians, the former chief ministers who've been detained, can be released. And this is really, for us, the way we see the roadmap for normalization of Kashmir. I don't think we are seeing that. I don't think we're hearing about that. I think, you know, this is a critical moment in the post-370 sort of history of Kashmir. The government needs to get this right.
No, the government definitely needs to possibly go back to the drawing board as far as Kashmir is concerned. And they seem to be stuck on the drawing board as far as Maharashtra is concerned. Well, one step forward, I suppose, because they've gone ahead and elected Devendra Fadnavis as the leader of the Legislative Assembly without... I don't know where that leaves the Shiv Sena right now.
It's so. A bit like... I mean, we keep, you know, comparing them to a bad marriage, right? I mean, and that's the most common analogy. I think it's the opposite. I think it's like two people who've decided to get married. They've, you know, for whatever, they've had a period of courtship and stuff. But when it comes to, like, the D-Day, one partner is unwilling to do the deed.
Perfect.
And the other partner is just going ahead. I mean, he's booked out the hall. He's booked out the pundits. He's, you know, even getting ready for the feras. That's kind of what is happening here. I mean, what's the next step here? Game this out. Today, they've elected Devendra Fadnavis as the Legislative Party leader. Tomorrow, they will go and meet the governor and stake claim.
Yeah.
And the day after, the governor will... you know, swear in Devendra Fadnavis. So he can be chief minister and constitutionally perfectly valid, because the governor needs to invite the single largest party or the single largest pre-poll formation.
Yeah.
In this case, the BJP is the single largest party. It's also part of the single largest pre-poll formation, except the other half of the formation doesn't want to form the government in such a hurry. So he can still very much be sworn in, and it could likely happen, you know, sooner than we think. And where does that leave the Shiv Sena? So I think it's just that Devendra Fadnavis seems to be sort of two steps ahead of what the Sena can do. And unfortunately for the Sena, I don't think they have much leverage. The only leverage they have is this threat that, oh, we have other options. We will go with the NCP and with the Congress. I haven't heard anything.
NCP is also making fun of the BJP and the Shiv Sena. Today, Sharad Pawar also came out with a cartoon on these two.
Exactly.
I mean, everybody's just watching this show play out.
And I don't think, you know, this grand idea of Shiv Sena plus NCP plus Congress in a bid to try and outwit the BJP, I don't think that's going to happen. Because if it was, A, we would have heard something to that effect from the leaders in the other side, that is from Sharad Pawar's party or from the Congress's side. And frankly, think about it. Why would Sharad Pawar, and he's only relevant in Maharashtra,
yeah,
and so is the Sena. And so his principal sort of fight is with the Sena, or at least the same turf that they're trying to fight with. The BJP has the whole of the country where they're fighting electorally. So is the Congress. They're fighting in large parts of the country. But if the Sena has to ally with Pawar, or Pawar has to ally with the Sena, it's going to have to be at the cost of their own vote
bank. Absolutely. They have a lot more to lose.
Yeah. So why would either of those two parties do it? So I think the BJP realizes this. I think the BJP realizes that the Sena is just bluffing, that there are other options on the table. Frankly, there are no other options on the table. Fadnavis is, like I said, ahead of the curve on this. Eventually, Uddhav Thackeray and the Shiv Sena will also have to catch up. Again, I don't think this rotational chief minister thing, I think that's a bluff. I think what they really want is the more plum portfolios. What they want is, you know, urban development and revenue, the so-called money-making ministries. I think that the Shiv Sena knows that at best what they can hope for is deputy chief minister. I don't think rotational chief minister will happen. You will see this over the next week, 10 days.
It's honestly like a game of wolf, and it's like it's been happening so often with the BJP and the Shiv Sena that you're frankly getting tired of it, and you just want them to just get their act together.
Exactly.
And then do something about it. Testing times in Maharashtra and also in the UK, Zaka.
Mm.
But actually, for once, something may have actually gone to plan for Boris Johnson. He's got his bid for early elections.
Yeah, and interesting, because I think this is finally the sort of the last act in this drama called Brexit that's been going on for the last, God knows, I think it's about more than three years now.
4 years now,
yeah. Yeah, almost 4 years. So I think it's smart because, A, he clearly sees that people are just fed up. They're just fed up with this just going on and on and on. There's a lot of anger in the country, and he's hoping that that anger gets translated in the elections against the Labour and the parliamentarians who've been sort of holding up this process. Even the ones who voted to remain are so frustrated by what's happened over the last few years that they're like, just get on with it. So Boris Johnson, you know, should be able to capitalize on that anger.
No, all the polls show that he's ahead.
Oh, well ahead. I think he's got a 15-point lead or something right now. Why I'm interested in the British election is, I think, you know, nobody really gave Jeremy Corbyn, when he first came 2-3 years ago, nobody really gave him a chance. I mean, this was after the so-called New Labour had been completely demolished. I mean, the Miliband's had such a discredited run. And eventually New Labour just completely collapsed, and they had to get this guy who basically cut his teeth as a trade unionist back from the 1980s when Margaret Thatcher was Prime Minister. So they got this sort of fossil from the 80s and said, you know, what is this guy going to do? Is he even going to survive? And he turned out to be surprisingly good. I mean, there were at least, I think, 2 coup attempts to try and get rid of his leadership. He survived both of that. And surprisingly, he started appealing to a good section of the people, not a large, but a good section of the old Labour vote. Why I'm interested in the British election is, I think this is the first time since the sort of rise of this phenomenon called the populists, with Donald Trump and Boris Johnson and Erdogan and who else, you know, you got Bolsonaro in Brazil. It's the first time you are actually seeing a populist on the other side.
Yeah.
Challenging a populist on the right. So I keep saying, you know, it's the populist nationalist versus the populist socialist.
Yeah.
And I'd really be curious to see how this plays out, because I think just like America, Britain is also very sharply divided between the right and the left. Right now, Boris Johnson has a 15-point lead. But we have seen, you know, stranger things happen in British politics. We have seen people narrow down 10, 15, 20-point leads and come back from behind and win. I'd be really interested in seeing this, because I think a version of this will play out next year in the U.S. elections as well. I think it's going to be, it's going to be Trump versus, in my assessment, either Warren or Sanders. And the reason I'm omitting Biden out is because I think Biden represents the old... Why did Clinton lose? Clinton represented everything that was wrong with the system for the last 30 years. She was the system. She was the establishment. Biden is just as much the establishment as Clinton was. And Trump was the ultimate anti-establishment guy. He railed against the establishment. That's how he won. The people on the left who are actually anti-establishment are Sanders, Warren to some extent, and of course now the darling of the left, AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. So I think those are the guys who are going to challenge the populists on the right. And so that's why I think the British election is going to be quite interesting to watch.
But three prime ministers in what, 4 years?
Exactly.
So David Cameron, the man who opened the Brexit floodgates, so to speak.
He lost power, then Theresa May lost,
Boris
and now
Johnson.
Boris. Boris has the best chance, because if he wins an overwhelming mandate, then, you know, we're going to have him around for a while.
Yeah.
He's going to be around not just for the next 5 years, unless there is a serious populist challenger on the left. Boris is going to run Britain for a very long time, just like Trump, many are saying, will run America for at least the next 4 years. So the thing is that it's a question of whether he can channelize the anger of the British people against Labour. And whether Corbyn can say that, look, this is a bunch of thugs, they can't seem to get anything done, elect me and I will get stuff done. So it's going to be these two sort of competing narratives that they will go to the British people with. Let's see who the British people choose.
All right, so these are just some of the stories that we'll be covering over 60 minutes on Brass Tacks at 9:25 tonight. So if you're tired of the debates and you just want the news, you know where to tune in. CNN News 18 at 9:25.
No debate, no bias, just the news. Brass Tacks with Zucker Jacob.